So just to give you like the background of why I thought I would teach this evening, I'm breaking with your tradition of whatever you're studying, is that we're really a month, right? We're now less than a month away from Pesach. So I thought that I can teach something around Pesach that maybe, if you want, you can bring to your Seder, you can think about it. So that's my motivation. And I guess the context for me is looking at what does it mean to be free, right?
So, what does it mean to be free?
To be free,
yeah, okay.
Right, to have freedom, right? Because if it's the holiday, right, it's the holiday of liberation, right? It's the holiday of freedom. So kind of looking at a couple of, you know, looking at Pirkei Avot on freedom, and then looking at the Gemara, which has, you know, like two, like small indications and frameworks of freedom in the context of like a piece of the Haggadah. So just to kind of give you kind of what I'm doing here. So we're in 6:2, where it says, and I'll read it in Hebrew and in English, and since we're going to do this piece in English, I know it's not necessarily your tradition to read and have the rabbi read. I'll do the Gemara piece. We can do Pirkei Avot because it's in English and it's relatively simple, I think. If it's not, if I'm putting you on the spot, let me know and I'll do all the reading and we can talk from there. So I'm interested in, if you look on the top, on the second to the bottom, where it says, Va'omer v'haluchot ma'asei Elohim, hema ha-michtav, michtav Elohim, Hu charut al haluchot. Al tikra charut ela cherut. She'ein lecha ben chorin or bat chorin. Ela misha osek b'talmud Torah. That's what I want to look at. So the English. The tablets were God's handiwork and the script of was God's script. Cherut engraved on the tablets. Do not...
Sorry, where are you?
I'm on the top of the pages that I told you in the English, 378 and 379 and 380 and 381. So Hebrew on one side, English on the other side.
Oh, okay.
Got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Cherut engraved on the tablets. Do not read Cherut engraved, but, and this is of course because, Cherut, but Charut, or in their language. Chairos and Charos, which who knows how to read that anyway, freedom. For you can have no freer man or woman than one who engages in the study of Torah. Yes?
So in Hebrew, charut, to engrave, is restet.
Is what?
No.
Lachrot something is chet reish tet. Charat is chet reish tet. That's the root, the shoresh.
The root, the shoresh?
Yes. So, maybe it's a different meaning altogether. Maybe
I mean, I'm going to say, Shehu Charut al Haluchot, this is how it's read in, written in the Torah.
So, somebody made a mistake somewhere.
Whoever made it a
mistake,
I mean...
Engrave, the Hebrew root for engrave is Chet Reish Tet.
Now I have to go and pull the dictionary. And
so that's whatever it's in here, it's a different story, but I'm telling you what is the root for to engrave something.
Yeah,
this is the
tav.
Test. He's saying it's not the same root.
It's not the same root.
Same and it's not.
Right, but the thing is, the rabbis, right, because this is, what is this tradition? It's an oral tradition. So a tet, I'm just saying,
yeah.
It is an oral tradition. Before it's written down, right, before anything is written down.
And it could
down,
be that they did it like this on purpose.
Yes, for sure, but I'm just saying that in the Torah, right, in the Torah, whoever made the mod, right, so Ben Yehuda, when he made the modern Hebrew, he wanted to make a distinction. But in the Torah, to engrave the luchot that God did is with a tav, not with a tet.
Now there is another charata, which is the same root as lachrot, something to engrave, it's with tet too.
It's what?
To be sorry, charata.
Oh, to feel badly. Okay,
to feel bad.
Right.
So it's the same root. So It could be that maybe we felt bad that it was written on the engraved on the tablets. I don't know. It could be three different options.
Well,
could
be
when
you feel bad, it's like engraved.
Yeah, it's like pushed into you.
Yeah.
That could be. But it's not. But
Mary.
Yeah. I'm also looking at my dictionary. What do you have? Morphix?
Because harut as a noun, spelled with a tet,
yeah,
is actually a cone. But that is a noun.
No, that's a different. That's
a cone. But I'm looking for the verb.
No, but it could be that the stam on purpose put it this way, so it will.
Well, I mean, so it could be
word,
right, because the one could be from engraving to.
Because otherwise, there is no meaning to the concept.
Right, I mean, but for me the interesting thing is, you know, right, the ways of Torah are pure and perfect, you know, so why, right, and one comes first, right, the Torah, I'm going to be a leap of faith and say the Torah was written, whenever it was written, before Ben Yehuda created the modern Hebrew language. So why he did what he did, I have no idea.
But Ben Yehuda took a lot of the new Hebrew words from Aramaic roots too.
Understood, but I'm just saying in the Hebrew it is with a tav.
In the Hebrew they've got two tavs for the two words. They've got them the same way.
He's arguing that. He's suggesting they made an error.
Well, Ron, yes, the variatia. There are variations here because there's also lachot with a taf, and it says Shem Poal Siman B'Charitza Chakak Charat B'Tet. Efshar Yesh Po Shnei Spelling.
Okay. And it's and hold on. Yes. And,
okay.
So Alkali says Chayrut with a tav, right? Freedom, liberty. Chayrut, name of the political right plane. Chayrut. Nope. At least according to Al.
It's not about chayrut, which is freedom. It's about the charut, which is the
engraving.
Engraving.
And it says here, charut as a...
There are two words there.
Engraved, carved, inscribed. Inscribed.
Yeah. It's correct.
It's with a tav. I mean, here, you can look.
I believe you. I mean, I have no doubt that they took it from somewhere.
Right, but I think that right,
and this is what the rabbis.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. Give up.
But here, but the rabbis, and this is what the rabbis.
okay.
I give you mechila. And I give you mechila. But I think this is what the rabbis. Hold on a second. Let's kind of gather again.
Yeah, okay.
This is what the rabbis are artfully doing. They do this all the time, where they reread the text. They reread the text all the time, right? In the prayers that you read before the Aleinu on Shabbat morning, it's very clear. Don't read it Banayich, read it Bonayich, right? Because there's no Nikud, right? There's no vowels. So they have the ability to, like, you know, say, oh, this is a great word, right? This is God is inscribing it and says, oh, it has the same letters as freedom. So we're going to say, okay, we're asking you to read it not as engraving, but read it as freedom. And, of course, for the rabbis, what's the greatest thing? What's the thing that gives you your freedom? We'll say knowledge, your intellect, right? And for them, la'asok, the Talmud Torah. Right, to really busy yourself to make sure that you are studying, you know, studying Torah. Right, that's freedom. Not you're okay, I'm okay, hedonism, anything else that comes to mind where, you know, I'm free and I have all of my, you know, all of my
options.
Right, all of my options, or that my bonds are torn apart and everything, but it's about really engaging in the study of Torah. It's about the study of Torah.
Why is Chayrut al Halachot necessarily a good proof text for that? Why does... No, I'm saying they're reading it as Chayrut. So yes. Why is Chayrut al Halachot... Why does that necessarily mean... Why does that have anything to do with Talmud Torah?
Well, first of all, we'll say it's the hi. It's the... We're on page... What page are we on? We're on page 381. In the package, sure. I think it's about that, right? First of all, that this is what God is writing, right? Is engraving the tablets, and for the rabbis, this is like the beginning of Torah, right? So it's the leap from the Ten Commandments and God writing the Ten Commandments, right? God literally engraving the letters into the stone, and then Moshe taking it down to the people, right? That those the ones that God wrote get smashed. Right, and Moshe has to write a different set. But I think that's their leap. That's why they're doing that, because God, right, God is the mover of that, right? Writes the Luchot, right, gives over the Torah, however we understand that, and then...
Right, but I'm just asking, if you read the words as Chevrut al HaLuchot, what does that mean?
Freedom on the tablets, that through the giving, so through
I
the...
I know the way they're... Do you think that... That suggests the meaning that they ascribe to it.
Yeah.
You do. Okay.
Yeah. Right, because we have to think about the scene and the things that you're thinking about when you walk into Pesach, right? Because if this is one of the conversations you can have for Pesach, is that they were slaves to in Egypt, to Paro, right? And that's a whole other thing about, you know, what does it mean to be enslaved and what is it to be there? And now if they're free, right, one could say, right, free! And, you know, free to be me or whatever the...
They need
you
to
know.
Keep the Shabbat, they need to keep the mitzvot.
Right, they have to...
There's freedom in that. The rules don't deny you freedom. They give you the ability to exercise your freedom. When you're a slave, you have no control over your life. So what's a sure sign of freedom than the fact that you make a choice to follow the system that's given to you?
And that's what I think it is. It's about the system that God gives, right? That's the path to freedom.
But it's Talmud Torah, right?
Well, that's what. So, but God's not. I mean, that's what. That's why we call Moshe Rabbeinu, right? As opposed to just Moshe, the prophet.
But they are elevating the study of Torah here.
That's correct.
But not just the practice.
Right.
Or not the practice.
Right. They are elevating that and engaging in that, because that's what they do and that's what they want people, right? You know, I'm not sure if the rabbis, if the rabbis really want everybody to become Talmidei Chachamim, I'm not really sure, right, or it's much more elitist in their mind, but for sure that Talmud Torah is the highest...
Can I get Kulam?
Right. Is one thing, yeah. It's a, right, if you study Torah, right, it leads to everything that you're supposed to do. So, and for the rabbis, that's the highest. I think that's really the highest value, is to sit around the room and study Torah. Right. So, what?
Study is above practice.
I mean, that's the there is a machloket, right, a conversation and of what the rabbis really feel about that, right? There's a thing, is it just Torah? Is it just study? What about deeds, you know? And what's your intention about your deeds? But I think, as Mark pointed out, in that piece of, of Mishnah, right, that says that, right, in Pirkei Avot, I think it's also in Pirkei Avot, if not in Mishnah Peah, maybe? I don't remember the exact source. Is that it's going to lead to everything, right? When you engage in Torah study, right, because the list is, you're going to do hachnasat orchim, you're going to, right, you're going to welcome the guests, you're going to bury the dead, you're going to daven three times a day. You know, it's that whole list, and those are the deeds, right? Those are the mitzvot. And then it says, you know, and Talmud Torah keneged kulam, and the study of Torah is equal to them, because it, and the rest of that sentence is because it leads to them. Right? So that if you just study, if you only study Torah, it is going to bring you to the place of practice. So can I tell you, I'll tell you a small anecdote referring to that. So that's my own story, right? Because people might know a little bit about me. So, right, I'm brought up in the Haredi community, so I have that in my background. But when I left, really, the Jewish conversation, I didn't do anything. And then when I started to re-engage in Judaism, it was through text study, and the text study brought me to teaching, and slowly I re-engaged in the practice. You know, I wasn't interested in it, but it just made more and more sense as I studied more and more, first with Torah, then with Talmud, and then all the subsequent things that I relearned and restudied, and brought me to that place, right, separate from what I was brought up with, right? So rejecting that, and then and here I am, pretty right wing on my observance. Not on my politics, though. But we won't do that.
I don't want to start a grammatical discussion about modern Hebrew, but I'm just curious: does anyone ever comment? Keneged is such an interesting word. Keneged has that notion of being against or part of something. Are there any drushes you're aware of that they try to suggest that Talmud Torah is, in other words, it has to be balanced between that and practice? That the Keneged doesn't mean it's equal to all of them, but has to be. One has to be careful not to go too far toward one direction opposed to the other.
I mean, I think inherent in it, it's true, but I'm not sure. I don't know anything offhand, but my gut reaction to that is, yes, of course, it's about, you know, it's what Maimonides says, that you have to be in the middle, right? You can't do either or. Shvil Hazahav in Hebrew, right?
Keneged is like if you have
weights.
So if you have one weight here and you put Keneged another one and it's equal, so Keneged could be equal.
No, I understand. But
that's how it's reading it. So he's wondering if it means like to bump up against.
Right, so
it's either equal, right? Is your partner equal to you, right? Or is your partner supposed to kind of push back on when you're doing something that's whatever, not in the system? So yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I think for sure it's both. And I think there's tension for the rabbis, right? And that I think in the subsequent history of the Hasidic movement, right, the Hasidim, right, the Baal Shem Tov made a big deal about that you didn't have to study, right? You didn't have to be in the Bet Midrash. You just needed to do something, right? Some things. You needed to do the practice because that would have brought you also into the conversation with God, and that it didn't leave you out, right? So anti-yeshiva movement kind of things, which was very elitist and things like that, right? But I'm just saying, that's what he's doing, saying, you know, do the mitzvot. That's why you have, you know, whatever, the mitzvah tanks of Chabad, saying, you know, did you put on tefillin today, or here's Shabbos candles, or whatever, because they're saying, you just have to do something. Something whistle and
like,
call it prayer.
I get sensitive. I don't like suggesting Baal Shem Tov was anti-yeshiva so much as he was giving an opportunity to people where there were no yeshivot, and he left. I mean, that area was devastated. So, I mean, he was showing another avenue.
Right, for sure.
He was hardly against one.
He had
a bunch of disciples. So, I mean, they were...
Right, but in terms of, like, his Torah to the world was just find something to do. Right, just because he didn't learn.
Exactly.
Just because you didn't learn, it didn't mean that you were less in the community. So
there's
good.
Also a famous exegesis on this on the phrase Naaseh v'nishma,
mm-hmm.
which is also Ma'amad Har Sinai.
Yes,
which means first you do and then you listen, which means you do it without even thinking. From doing, you get to understanding. So it's the other direction also.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's. Yes, I think that's in play here too.
Right.
And that's also that's a way that a child learns,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like the child doesn't, you know, until the child is older with each of the ages, it gets older and understanding different things, right?
Do it eventually, you'll understand why you're doing it.
Right.
New science of the brain. It says that when you get into a position or a facial expression, that then you feel it. So actually doing brings on the emotion and the whole mental state. So it's very interesting because you're saying that, but now they're actually finding that chemically, neurologically, that happens in the brain.
That's cool. thing you say is about smiling.
That's right.
If you smile, make yourself smile.
Do it.
You begin to feel it eventually.
It lights up in the brain.
So let's just read on the bottom of 382, where it says, when a person engages in the study of Torah.
Which page?
382, and it's on the bottom, where it says, when a person engages in the study of Torah.
Look at the bottom.
Yeah, well, the bottom section.
The bottom section, where this is the Maharal. So when a person engages in the study of Torah, he or she is more than free. She is elevated above this lowly world that is limited in every dimension. That growth emerges through the quality of humility, which frees us from the fear of being ridiculed and from trying to attract admiration. Once we are free of arrogance, we can think and grow without limit. And this is the Maharal's take on everybody who studies Torah, who engages in study, is elevated, becomes elevated.
Did the Maharal use the pronoun she?
I use the pronoun she. Because I wrote, I said he, she, and then I switched to she, which I'll do on occasion. Because we're talking to everybody.
Interesting. He once tried to, it seems, elevate, make something above freedom. He's saying when you engage in the study, you're more than free. Whereas the text itself seems to, you know, sort of equate freedom and Talmud Torah. But he's saying that's
step one.
That's step one, right? There are steps beyond that.
Right. And why do you think that's so?
I don't know. I'm saying that's not a necessary conclusion or inference from the text.
Right.
This is his,
This is his take on
this
it.
This is his take on it.
Right. This is his midrash on the midrash. Right. Anybody have any thoughts or?
It's a nice idea, but I don't know what more than free means, really. It means free in a different way. It's a different take on freedom.
I mean, and he's also right. The Maharal is thinking about the that growth emerges through the quality of humility, right? So there's something about the study of Torah and one's freedom, right? Or a look at one's freedom to not be arrogant, right? To not take it for granted, to not take it in a place of arrogance, and to bring it into humility, which is not usually right. It's usually the opposite, right? Because you feel full. Right, and when you feel full, it's about it's a whole different expression, and it's a whole different meaning versus, okay, now that you're free, now that you're engaging in Torah, right? Watch it, right? You know, there's some arrogance in knowledge or knowing or whatever, right? So it's saying, like, take a breath, right, in that way, and be humble. So the drash there is that's like the matzah. Right, that's the drash, that the matzah is deflated. The matzah is the bread of affliction, but spelt the same way as anav. Right, inui has that vav, so without vowels, it could be read right as humility.
Okay.
I'm glad that it's relating to it. It's good. Yeah.
So I have a question about mit'ale.
Mm.
So only people who study the Torah are in the category of mit'ale.
Mm-hmm.
So those Jews who practice all the Taryag mitzvot with no, they don't miss anything, they are not mit'ale. They are not as good as the other.
He doesn't say that.
It says Talmud Torah mit'ale.
If I say to you, everybody who plays poker is happy, it doesn't mean everyone else in the world is. He's talking about it.
Because they put in a category the whole mishu osek b'Talmud Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are many people who just follow the mitzvot,
mm-hmm.
and they don't
mm-hmm.
study the Torah. They
mm-hmm.
just follow the mitzvot.
Mm-hmm.
Are they in the same category?
I mean, okay, so are you asking me personally, like as the person who's teaching here, or what do I think that the rabbis are getting at?
The latter. Why don't we hear the latter first?
Well, who's is this the Maharal saying that?
Or? No, that's on top. If you say Osek, right. Osek b'Talmud Torah. See, I stopped it there.
Right,
because I didn't really want to go into that the mitaleh.
This category brings me to seeing mitaleh as a mifchar. You know, we have an issue with the chosen.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder.
I'm not going up to there, but you're stretching it. Higher than where you were before.
I think, like I said before, I think that Talmud Torah is the highest values for the rabbis. So one who engages in Torah study, right, Talmud Torah, Torah study, is really up there, right? People who just do Taryag Mitzvot without study, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, that was the
some definition of Judaism is really just to follow the Mitzvot.
Not if you really know. I don't agree. I don't agree. Hold on a second. So the person who davens every day, right? You're talking about person davens every day, and the first thing that they do after, right? They put on tefillin, they go Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kedeshanu B'Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu La'asot B'Divrei Torah, V'Harev Na Da 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 Da. How could they not elevate? How could they, you know, is it they're just saying the words? Then we have a conversation of people who just, you know, are robots, complicated, right? They're, you know, I don't have a lot to say about it. But it's like doing it without heart. And right away, I mean, if you're a serious, right, davener, if, you know, before you even get into anything, you are acknowledging the fact that you are engaging in Torah, and then immediately start studying Torah through your davening experience. That's why you have the Mishnah. That's why you have Talmud. That's why, right, because the rabbis constructed it that way to say, you have to go out to work. You can't really study, but we're going to create a davening experience that has pieces of Torah, so that's why you have the Shema, and that's why, and the three paragraphs that come after that, and that's why you have Psalms in there, and that's why you have, like I said in the beginning, your Mishnah, Talmud, all of that. Right, you have, you know, and then before you make your first, you know, it's Kaddish Rabbanan, it's all about the selections, right? Even in Sim Shalom, if you're davening from Sim Shalom, you have sections from the rabbis, right? Because they want you to engage it, like you're bringing up, to use those muscles, right? Those muscles of prayer and of intellect to then be able to do it. So you can't help but, that's what I'm saying, you can't help but. If they don't act that way, I can't be responsible for how people act. It's hard enough to be responsible for me acting the way I act. So, I don't know if that's satisfying to you, but...
No, I mean, not so satisfying, you know, I'm an Israeli.
All right, so why don't, so there's another, so... I really love Sfat Emet, so let's read one piece of Sfat Emet, and then we'll get into the Gemara. Hold on a second. Let me see.
Sarah, well, can I say, do you have any idea how that proof text from the Bamidbar proves that proposition about Mitzvah?
Because they're playing around with the journey, right? So, Mimatana Nach...
I don't remember the context, but I don't
know. So Bamidbar 21:19, I think they're going on their travels. It's a place where they travel. There's a Tanakh.
Okay,
somewhere.
I don't want to take it. It's not that important.
No, but I'm just saying, I mean, when I looked it up, it's just kind of places where they went,
yeah.
Right? And it's the whole thing of, right, Mitaleh, right, is about going up, right? So it's about going up into Israel. Right, so it was one of those stops where they made. So if you go, it's the Nasa'ot.
How is that a Shin Emar relating to Harez and Mitzvah?
Because they're going up into Israel, and also Bamot. What's Bamot? Bamot is a high place. So they're playing around in their mind.
Okay.
It's going from just. This is when the rabbis are a little like.
And that's not a good proof text for the proposition that they just said.
It's not always perfect. It's not always perfect, but, you know, they have to source it in the Torah, right? So they're thinking about journeys, and they're thinking about moving from one place to another. So I think that that's what it is. And also, they can play around. Mi matana, what does a matana mean? From the gift of getting Torah, right, from the gift, so this is my drash, right? So from getting the gift of Torah, at, you know, matana, and then going into, and then being raised up high.
Maybe that's right.
To be that.
That your midrash is actually what they're getting at, because I otherwise don't see it.
Right. But I think that, although it's not being explained, and nobody's picking up on it, I think that, at least for me, that's how I would, that's, you know, if I was writing a midrash on it, that's what I would be speaking about. Okay, a teeny, teeny little piece from the Sfat Emet. I'm on page 442. No excuses for neglecting Torah. And then the other one, body and soul reconciled. We're not going to read it here, but this is for you to take and think about bringing to your Seder. That's the, you know, so you can do that too. Right, so you see, no excuses for neglecting Torah. We frequently rationalize neglecting Torah study because of our obsession with the mundane concerns of daily life. Ah, this speaks to... What's your name?
Ran.
This speaks to you. The Mishnah rejects this excuse and assures us that, on the contrary, by immersing ourselves in Torah, we are better able to cope with all of those concerns.
So a good Christian who studies Torah all day long is a better Jew than a Jew that follows all the mitzvot.
You can't just study without practicing. That's clear. But there's a value to study that is independent of practice.
Okay, so you would say study and practice.
You can't, to be a good Jew, you can't neglect to practice. Yes. That's the traditional
right.
view, of course.
Right, it's a, I mean, the Reform movement, on the other hand, right, rejects halakha. Right, just to bring it up, right, so there is a place...
I'm talking about the classical view.
Right, but I'm just saying, you know, like, that was one of the things. They, you know, so there was a rejection of halakha, right, that halakha became autonomous, right, not prescribed in any which way, but really highly regards the intellect and the study of Torah, and, you know, Torah in the broadest sense of the word. And they produce a lot. And the interesting thing is, if you have a chance to read the responsa literature that comes out of the Reform movement, it's very serious halakha, but they just, you know, but it's, you know, right, but it's an intellectual pursuit versus this is what we want you to do, unless the rabbi in their community takes it seriously. But for a Christian to study Torah, I mean, the thing that separates him from us, or her from us, is that, there's a belief in a Messiah, right? So there's no conversation. It's like two different religions using the same core. But if you Google any topic, the first five hits, unless you really narrow it into a more, more Jewish sense, the first five hits are always in the Christians. Are always Christian Hebrews, Christian, because they are thinking and writing a lot about the text. Not necessarily rabbinic, but for sure that the five books of Moses.
Not all of what our rabbis in the past wrote is always correct, you know.
What can I say?
I
you know, we want to study before Shavuot and Pesach, so we need to get into this freedom.
You're saying the prevalence is not just the majority of Christians, but that there is more writing that's produced. Therefore, when you look it up, you'll get more citations.
No, there's, you know, you have to just narrow your search, but there is a lot of stuff, good and bad, you know, interesting and not interesting, from the Christian point of view.
Using the same Jewish term,
I mean, there are keywords that will tell you that it's not Jewish, like, so they use, you know, the New Testament version. Yeah. I mean, there's versions. So as soon as you see, you know, the abbreviations, you say, oh, it's Christian side, because it looks Jewish. All right. How about if we do a little Gemara?
Okay with you?
All right. So 116A, if you're in... So if you're in the Vilner, you're on this side. This is side A. If you're in the translation, you're just on the front, where it says Talmud class March 30th. So you can do it side by side. Okay, so... And we can do as much, you know, I'm going to assume that there might be some conversation. I have Ron here, you know, he's my worthy opponent, my chavrutam, the thing that bumps up against me. I just hope that you do the same thing to the rabbi that you're doing to me.
No, it's worse to me.
Yeah, he does.
All right, so I'm at the Mishnah. Mazgulo kosheni. V'kan haben shoel aviv. V'im ein da'at baben aviv milamdo. I'm in, so I am right, kuf ted zayin dat, and I'm seeing in the middle right here it says mem tet nun chupchik is the Mishnah.
With the shady mind.
Right. Mazgolo kos sheni.
Kuf tet
zayin.
The top line, the very top, does it say afkan for pursa?
Yes.
All right, I'll find it.
Right below the shaded line.
So right above the end of the shaded line.
Okay.
Right.
Good.
Matnitin, the Mishnah. Mazgu. Everybody got it? I'm going to read it first in Hebrew. Right, Hebrew, Aramaic, but most of the text is in Hebrew. I'm going to read it in Hebrew, and then I'm going to read it in English. Okay, everybody good? Everybody on the same, literally on the same page? In the same location? Do I have to, like, app you and say, would you like to accept location or not? Right, you got to be in the reality. Okay, so. Mazgulo kos sheni v'kan haben shoel aviv. V'im en da'at baben aviv milamdo. I just want to stop there, right? So the person, the attendant is pouring or mixing the second cup. And here, the son asks the father. And if the son isn't able to, doesn't have the intellect or the ability to ask, the father teaches him. So, before I even start, right, so we're in the Seder, right, we're in the Kosheni of the Seder, right, so we've gone through Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpas, right, Yachatz, somewhere in there you poured your second cup. So why does the Mishnah say, right, they mix the cup, they bring the cup, and the son is now going to be motivated to ask the question, why? Well, no, because now we're going to say, right, the next line is Manishtana Halayla Hazemi Kol Halaylot, and we're going to go through, like, what the rabbinic version of it is, not the version that you have in your Haggadah. But it says immediately, they mix the wine or they serve the wine, right, and the son is immediately going to, so think about a typical meal. A regular meal, not a meal on Pesach. When would you pour a second cup?
When you finish the first one.
For benching.
I would think
bingo.
What?
For benching. But what just happened?
They didn't eat.
They didn't eat. Right, so this is, I'm just saying, this is the backdrop. This is why he's asking. It's not that manishtana, right, it's just not arbitrary. Manishtana halayla hazemi kol halaylot. Right? But it's like he's reacting, the child is reacting to what he or she is seeing. Right? That you made Kiddush, you drank wine. Okay, that's a typical thing. Right? What happens on a regular Shabbat or Chag? We go, we wash, we break bread, and then we eat. And yes, you can drink wine during the meal, but not with a bracha until after the benching.
Well, why didn't they do it before the blessing over the bread, because here we have matzah. That would be the first point that you would do this.
No, but you have kadesh, right? You have kiddush. So then you have your cup, and you're gonna, in reality, you're gonna have you're going to have two more cups before you even eat your meal. And then you have your third cup, right? Your fourth cup, I should say.
The potency comes before the second cup,
doesn't
it?
During Pesach? No.
On a regular meal, that's why it's different.
Right, on a regular meal, in terms of the construction, the rabbinic construction of a meal,
right,
is you have kiddush, you drink wine, and you can drink wine during the meal, but there is no blessing, extra blessing, and then
you get to the meal.
So
you have the motzi.
Yeah, and then you have motzi.
Right. So right at the motzi, things are different. That would be a point where the child would say, "Why is this night different?"
No, but he's a good. But the father is refilling the cup.
Oh, before the motzi?
No, after he just did karpas. He just did the bitter, the eating of the greens.
Right. Long before.
And long before Hamotzi, we're going to have the whole story of the Passover. We're going to say basically the whole Haggadah before we get to Motzi.
Okay, this is the first point then, is what you're saying.
This is the first point where things are
out of
whack. For a child, right, to notice, right, and this makes a lot of assumptions. Right, the child notices. There's a lot of assumption that it's a house that has all of the rituals, right? Stuff like that. So we have a lot of that going on. But the rabbis are saying most people should know this. So that's why the question is right exact here, because the kid is reacting to what he sees, and the pedagogy there is children often say, "Why?" Right? I was preparing here and doing some work, and your children were studying in their Hebrew school, and they did a sidra scene, and there was in that half an hour, I can't count how many whys that the kids asked. Why this? Why this? So I don't understand that. What happened? Oh, really? And the teacher was like fielding those questions and stuff like that, but that's, so if you really pay attention, you do something, and kids are constantly asking, why, right? Why are you doing that? So that's what's going on here. And interestingly, right, so if the child doesn't have the ability, the father is supposed to teach him, right? So there's the whole notion of that if the child doesn't know it, if the ben, and this is a ben, and we're going to see in the piece that women are also included, so this is one of the reasons why I often will bring this piece, because it will has a child, it has a woman, and it will have a slave. And those are those crazy categories the rabbis don't know what to do with. So.
And here, Sarah,
yep.
Lamdo means teach him the question.
Yes, teach him the question.
Okay, because Lamdo is going to be used again later at
yes.
the end. So
right.
It just means it's the same. It's the same meaning.
Right, so it's going to be, it's like in the children's question, right, she'eno yodea lish'ol, right, what do you do? Petachlo, right, you open for him, you tell him, like you tell him what he should be paying attention to, right? So this is, right, again, it's if we think about it in pedagogic terms, right, which makes sense, if the child can't ask, then the father says, I'm going to tell you, right, I'm going to teach you. So manish tana halayla hazem mikol halaylot shebachol halaylot anu ochlin chametzu matzah halayla hazem kulo matzah. Do I need to translate? I can do it in Yiddish if you want. Shebachol halaylot anu ochlin she'ar yirakot halayla hazem maror. Okay, so it's the vegetable versus bitter herb.
How does it sound in Yiddish?
Shebachol halaylot anu ochlin basar tzali saluk umvushal, halayla hazek kulot sali. Different from what we have, which means I will, I'll tell you. So it's on all other nights we eat meat that is roasted and cooked and all sorts of other things, right? But this night we only eat roasted. Right, so we don't do that one. Shebachol halaylot anu matbilim pam achat halayla hazeh shtei pa'amim. And I think in your text it's slightly different, because I'm in the Koran and they corrected. So let me see what it says here. your version has a lot of parentheses, right? Shebechol halaylot ein anu chayavim litabel afilu pam achat halayla hazeh shtei pamim. Okay, so again, it's a little bit different. All other nights we dip the vegetables in a liquid during the meal only once. However, on this night we dip twice. So now already we're going to find that people are not happy with it, but because that's not exactly what we do. Do you remember what the Haggadah says? On all other nights, Ein anu matbilim. So they're gonna. So we're in the piece of Gemara that teases that out. So it says Ein anu matbilim afilu pamachat halayla hazeh shtei pamim. Right. That we don't even. Right. We don't even dip during the year one time this night twice. And again, this is to motivate the child to ask questions. Ulefida atoshal ben aviv milamdo. Right, so according to the intelligence of the child and the ability of the child, his father teaches him. And this is what he's teaching him. Matchil begenut umisayem b'shvach. Right, or b'shevach, right? So he starts, so this is what he teaches him. We begin the story of Pesach with
slavery
or lowliness. Genut is like disgust, right? And we end with praise. The other thing you need to do, right, because you don't have the Vilna is not pointed, v'doresh me'arami oved avi, in quotes, ad shigmor kol ha'parsha kulo. So not only are you supposed to tell the story of slavery into freedom from the horrors of the experience to the, you know, to praising God, but you also are supposed to doresh. So we have to talk about what that means, to Doresh, on the piece of Deuteronomy 26:5, which says, my father was a wandering Aramean, or an Aramean tried to destroy my father. And this is also the interesting thing, that this is also the declaration that one recites when presenting his first fruits at the temple for Bikurim. So when you bring Bikurim on Shavuot, this is, you read this piece of Deuteronomy. So before we start the Gemara, why does the rabbis tell us that not only are we supposed to talk about the story, but we're also supposed to doresh?
I don't know what doresh means.
Ah.
I think it's
somebody explain. So what's the translation of doresh?
Doresh is demand.
Okay, so that said, that's modern.
Modern. And Doresh in here is Midrash.
Right, to interpret, to expound. Okay, to interpret and to expound. Okay, so we're supposed to interpret and expound on this piece of
not
Torah.
Not just read it, but interpret and expound.
That's so correct. So if you pay attention, so this is, I'm going to, you'll indulge me. At this Seder, what you'll do is, after the Haggadah writes the phrase, you know, does the Pesukim from Deuteronomy 26, they do expound on it. They say, Avi, Oved, and then they give all the explanations from Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Hoshua, and all of that is expounding on it because the assumption is the regular person around the table might not have the facility to do it, so they do it for you. If you have the facility to do it or to prepare in advance to say, I'm going to doresh, I'm going to expound, I'm going to bring something modern, the chavod would be an honor, according to the rabbis, because you are required to doresh on it. They've done it for you, but it's embedded in your Haggadah. And I think that it's really interesting in terms of the pasuk that, or the pesukim that they want you to expound upon, right, which is perhaps the beginning of the story, right, because who is the Aramean who tried to destroy my father? Right, it's the story, so which is the foreshadowing, right, Jacob, right, Yosef has to go down to Egypt. Yaakov has to go down. The tribes have to go down. So if we think about the foreshadowing, it's really, it's not necessarily genut what's happening. It's the beginning of it, right?
No, but the genut of Jacob and his son is that he's slaving for 14 years. So he started
for 20 years.
Or 20 years, but at least for 14, that was mandatory.
Right.
So he, that's the gnut.
That's the beginning of
beginning,
it.
Beginning. It was so long. And then, he became a free man at the end of the story when they came back out of Egypt.
Right. But they're drawing your attention that it's just not about Egypt. It's not about Eileh Shemot, right, which is the beginning of Exodus. It's really about, the last third of Bereshit. Right, we're going all the way back. That's the imagery. We're going all the way back to that story. So again, in the context of teaching children, right, in the evening, you are teaching your children basically the whole story. Right, from Jacob to Joseph and everything in between. Because it doesn't tell you the limit, and that's why the rabbi stayed up until the students came and told them it was time for Kriyat Shema Shel Shacharit. Right? All right. Are we okay? Any questions, thoughts, comments? All right. Gemara. Tanu Rabbanan. So this is a brayta. The sages taught. Chacham bino shoalo. Vim ein chacham ishto shalto. Ve'im lav hu shoel la'atzmo, ve'afilu shnei talmidei chachamim sheyodim behilchot ha-pesach, shoelim ze laze. So if the son is wise, if he's a smarty, he asks, he gets to ask the question. And if not, if the son is not, then the wife asks. And if she's not able...
Ask him or ask
asks him, meaning whoever is running the Seder, she gets to ask the question to that person.
Instead of the child.
So there's a hierarchy. The son is a chacham, a wise guy. He gets to ask. If not, she gets to ask.
So, but that's not according to what they say, because it is not chacham, aviv melamdo. And here it goes one level down to his wife, rather than, so there is no teaching after the question is not raised correctly.
No, but then, and if not, if she's not able to do it, then he asks himself. Meaning what is going on is that the questions have to be asked. Now the question is, right, and the Gemara really doesn't go into it, is it the prescribed Manish Tanah HaLaila HaZeh, or is it the questions in general? Right, as, depends on the type of siddarim you've been to, right? But I've been to ones where, you read the prescribed and then all of a sudden, especially if you have a lot of kids around the table, everybody has a packet that they learned at the school and they're asking a dozen questions around the table, right? Not necessarily having anything to do with the Manish Tanah, but having to do with,
the story of
Pesach. Yeah.
Is that encouraged, that extracurricular question, is that encouraged or?
Yeah, for sure, because we're going to read about, there's a piece in it that resonates deeply with me, and we'll get to that hopefully, but yeah, you are supposed to ask those questions, you are supposed to have ancillary conversations.
I think Ron is actually asking a very good question.
Yeah.
Which is, there seems to be a tension between the Mishnah and the Braita.
For sure.
The Mishnah says, if the son doesn't know how to ask, the father should teach him.
Mm-hmm.
That the Braita suggests that if the son doesn't know how to ask, there's this hierarchy of asking.
Yes.
That's totally absent from the Mishnah.
That's correct.
Is that picked up on at all?
This
Braita doesn't seem to just explain the Mishnah. It actually seems offering, to be consistent with it.
Well, it's not. We're going to find a few inconsistencies, but I think that right. So. The Mishnah, right, so just giving you context. So the Mishnah is edited in 200, and the Gemara is edited 600, approximately 650. So, and the Braita comes from a similar time period as the as the Mishnah. So I think that they're bringing, you know, like if you think about the construction, I think they're bringing that teaching because it does come in conflict with or bumps up against Keneged. It bumps up against the Mishnah. It is a different, it's a variant reading.
And doesn't it say us? Doesn't it say the female that you should, in the Haggadah, doesn't it say if the child doesn't know, you should, using the feminine form of Anadata, at, should teach?
At Patachlo, yes, but I think that's just Mishnaic Hebrew.
Well, but I was told that that means that that's like a instruction to the mother, that when the child doesn't know, it could be a very young child, and this is...
I mean, it's an it's a great feminist reading. I'm not sure that that's the reality, but it's a nice feminine reading, yeah.
Can we just follow up on what...
It's not feminine. It's
ancient Hebrew.
What I was getting at, the Gemara does not immediately address that tension between the bright and the...
That's
mission.
Correct.
It goes on to address the rest of the mission.
Right.
Does it ever come back to the
tension? To the Sha'aloh? I don't think so.
There really is a different... That's what I was getting at. There's a different conception of the question and answer sequence in the mission of the bright.
Right, because one is saying the father has an obligation, right, because it goes
right,
back to
no
a
role,
different...
Right.
Right, the wife has no role, but he has an obligation,
right
in the Mishnah, it's in Kedushin, right, in Kedushin around in the 30s, that says, that gives, like, what the father has to do for his son, and, right, he's supposed to teach him Torah, right, so this is exactly what this is. If he doesn't know, the father has a responsibility and obligation to teach him, right, and in that Mishnah... The Mishnah is not that Gemara, right? The rabbis say, and if not the father, then the community, and if not the community, then the mother. So the mother is in there, but it's like way after. And if it's not the mother, then when the child becomes the age of majority, has to go out and do it himself.
The community is before the wife.
Yes, in that Mishnah, in that Gemara. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So not here. So
no, I understand. I'm just
right.
I'm surprised.
So here, I think in the Mishnah, it's really about teaching, right? And father's responsibility to teaching his son, right? That's that deep relationship. When it comes to the Braita, they're saying it's not about teaching. It's about Sha'aloh.
Right. It seems the Braita seems to suggest that
you have to read.
Ask the question. You have to have understand.
You have
the
to have.
The Mishnah seems to suggest if the son has no understanding, you teach him how to ask.
Right. You teach him how to ask, which is great, right? Because that's what we want to do. We want to teach our children. We want to teach our children. It's not giving them the answer. Give me the answer, right? That's what they say, right? Just give me the answer.
Nowadays they will Google it.
It doesn't matter what they're doing, but they you know, for whatever reason, in the child's framework, they want to be provided with the answer, right? But what does the parent often say? No, like, what's the question you are asking, right? What are you trying to get to, right? Because if not, the child doesn't learn anything, right? The child has to engage in the text. And if the rabbis, if we just studied, the highest value is Osek, right, is Talmud Torah. The father has to do Talmud Torah with his child. He has to teach him how to ask those questions. He has to put it in the framework so that, you know, if not, then you are remiss in your obligation to your child's education.
Right, you have to melamed not just the answers, but the questions.
Right,
the Mishnah,
right.
Right, that seems to suggest something.
Right, so the Mishnah is saying, Sha'aloh, to ask. So two things are going on, I think. People can, you know, say what you think. One, it's about the literal, right? So you have to, like you said, you have to have foreknowledge of what the question is. But the other thing is, they're just saying, just ask the question. Manishtana halayla hazemi kol halaylot. And that's kind of the tradition that's been handed down through the generations is, what do you do? Tell me your name.
Bobby
said, all we do is read it. Right? So the rabbis, someplace between the Mishnah and the Braita, the rabbis are saying, just ask. And if they're reading it or saying it, the son doesn't do it, the wife does it. And if the wife doesn't do it, he does it, and he does it.
Why they don't have the guests?
This I you know.
That's the confusion, isn't it? They have the community.
Yeah, so they don't say that why there is no one more step, that the wife is not against.
Maybe they're thinking that it's small family units and they're poor and, you know, they're in Babylonia or in Rome already, because right, and they're far away and who knows, right? And it's also about family, I think, here. Even though we do have guests and you're supposed to, but I think that in the question and the construction of the question, it has to do with family unit. Okay? The afilu, right? And even if you have two Tamidei Chachamim who know all of the halachot of Pesach, Shoalim Zelazeh. So they are supposed to ask the question. So what are they? They're supposed to say the Haggadah or ask those questions. Right, because if they know everything, right, then they can have this rich conversation on the exact, precise meaning of the words. And I think here it's about everybody to their ability. But you have to engage. You are not patur from engaging in the asking of the question or the teaching, if you want to say that questions include teaching. Right, but nobody is, nobody escapes. Nobody escapes. Okay, so we're back to the Manishtana. Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halaylot. Shebechol halaylot anu matvilim pam echat halayla hazeh shtei pamim. Okay.
So I have a question in general for the Manishtana. Why they selected this kind of concept of Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halaylot with the arba kushiyot? And not any other question. How come it was narrowed to this kind of format? And not like different question. What's the story of why Jacob had to work 7 years for Laban? You know, I'm just throwing something to the air.
Why these questions?
Why? Yes. How it narrowed to this kind of question?
The fifth question is why these other four questions.
Right.
I mean, I think it's like what the experience of the evening thus far has, or is going to be, right? Why is this night different, right? You can eat chametz and matzah all the year round, right? So that's the first thing, because in the beginning, right, what do? You just did yachatz, right? So you're pulling...
So why not to ask the first question, why we have the seder?
Because that's too big.
Implicit, I mean, you're getting there.
A children's perspective on activities. You know what I mean? It's
I think that's one of the things.
Thing.
Right. I think it's really about children.
Of how they, what people do. It's not asking, you know, what's the meaning of freedom. It is, why do we do these things that we say?
Correct. But they are specifically saying it's from Gnut to Shevach. The whole story is from Gnut to Shevach. And we are
you have to translate that for her.
Gnut to Shevach is from being in the lower level to Shevach is to freedom and
praising God.
And praising, yeah. So between Gnut to Shevach, I can ask a lot of other questions why we just did
right,
twice.
So let's think
so,
about
I mean,
it.
There could be
it's pedagogic. It is. This is the first interactive. Informal educational experience for the Jewish people. That's for anybody who's in Jewish education, right? This is interactive. You get to touch and feel and play and do also, you put your fingers in the wine. You get to do all sorts of things, right? And the longer your children stay up, you know, it might be a kvetch to you, but the happier they are because they can, you know, they're starting to experience. So this is a very, very hands-on experiential. And in terms of the gnut to zinc, to me, this is how I read it. Matzah and chametz u'matzah. Chametz, right, depends on... Can I run on the board? I have a great drash. You should bring it to your table. I'm writing in Hebrew, but I'll explain it to you. You have to write it in, which is horrible, which really should be chametz. Right, that doesn't do that. And, well, terrible.
It's perfect.
Okay, so what's the difference between chametz and matzah? Because you have mem, and you have sadi,
And you have?
What's the difference?
Three.
A teeny, teeny little faith. So all you need is a little bit of chametz, literally spoilage, to inflate the matzah. So just in those two words, my mind, right, so when I teach at a Seder, which I haven't taught at a Seder in a long time, but when I do the teaching, I talk about that. So right away, manesh tana halayla hazem mikol halaylot, shebachol halaylot anu ochlim chametz, chametz. Umasa, this is my genut, and this is my shevach.
God will help you with this shevach of matzah.
Well, because it's about humility. It's what we studied. It's about humility. It's about being low.
Right.
It's lacking arrogance. This is about arrogance. This is arrogance. This is
deflating,
like
deflating.
And this is deflating. Correct.
No, what we actually at the Seder we do according to that Gnut and Shevach we do on the Seder night Chametz with Matzah because on we do from Gnut to Shevach.
Right, and that's why we do Chametz and Matzah.
We do same Shevach Cholot and Ochlim Chametz and Matzah. On all other nights we have Chametz and Matzah. If you're equating those things,
right,
you're saying on all other nights we do Gnut and Shevach, but it's really on the Seder night that we do.
Well, because most people don't really eat matzah during the year. It's just something that we're kind of...
It doesn't mean actually eating.
No, I know, but it's the question says, on all other nights, we're entitled to eat both chametz and
right.
Matzah. So if you're equating chametz gnut and matzah to shevach,
yep.
I'm not sure that drash works, because it's saying on all other nights, we have both gnut and matzah.
We have this tension between gnut and shevach. We don't really, like, it's all mixed up. It's not really separated, right? It's in the mix. Right, you have the ability to spoil your matzah and to inflate ongoing during the year.
Yeah, my only point is, on the Seder night, we don't just have Shevach.
That's correct, but I'm addressing kind of the image when I hear Chametz u'matzah, halayla hazeh kulo matzah, that in that phrase, what comes to my mind is arrogance and humility, and Gnut and Shevach. That's all. I'm not sure it's the reality, but like, right, so if Ron is saying, so where's the why aren't we talking about Shevach and Gnut? And I'm saying, yeah, we are. Right? The whole story is in those four questions. Right? I'm talking about Chametz and Matzah. So the image, and it'll say, right, because Matzah is one of the things you have to like, point to or lift up during the thing, and you have a whole formula that you say when you bring up the matzah. The next question is maror. I'm reminded of the bitterness, and the bitterness can go anywhere from Yaakov to Yosef to Mitzrayim. And then the next one is, in this one it's about roasted, so the image is the Paschal offering, right? So the lack of the Beit HaMikdash, what was it like? Do I want that? Do I like that? You know, but what was it like for that Pesach, the first Pesach, when they're, you know, putting blood all over the place and God is jumping over their houses? Right, you have all, so that's the story. And what's the fourth one is about matbilin, right, about dipping, which means this is about, that's the freedom, right, that we are rich enough, wealthy enough, whatever, to be able to dip. Not only once, which we never do, but it's dipping twice, which was a sign of, you know, of abundance.
Do you associate matzah with Shevach or with Gnut? Yeah, I see there you put it with Shevach. I guess I don't.
Because it's about humility. So I equate...
Right, that's what, I mean...
No, it's not lechemoni. It's about... It's like what we... It was like with the... Was it the Sfat Emet who said, or the Maharal who talked about humility? Yeah, it was the Sfat Emet who talked about humility. That Talmud Torah, the Talmud...
Itale. Itale.
I know, I'm just talking about matzah, I'm talking about Talmud Torah. In the Haggadah, it's referred to as lechemoni. I mean, there are different interpretations of what matzah is,
right,
what it's supposed to
be. So again, you know, like to do what the rabbis do, right? How do you spell homi?
Yeah.
So if this is Oni, right, which means affliction, right,
But if you play around, it's anav, which means humble. I'm just saying that's what the rabbis would do. That's what the rabbis do in play. Right? Don't read it this way, read it this way.
It's useful.
I'm just saying, I know you're thinking, Matt, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I think that I'm trying to offer an alternative reading, that's all. If you don't like it, you don't have to like it. I'm comfortable with that.
Metaphor.
Yeah, I'm just saying it could be the metaphor for the exact opposite. That's all right. Oh, but, okay.
Yeah, but...
Because we think, so here's the interesting thing, it's because we think about, again, it's thinking about freedom. Right, if that's what it's talking about, how do you represent freedom? Is it about being inflated and full? Right, because we were talking about that with the Talmud Torah piece. Right, is it that the Talmud Torah or the experience is supposed to give you some type of humbling experience? Right, that we shouldn't take it for granted. Right, that the shevach or the freedom, the liberation shouldn't be taken granted of. So if that's the case, then if anything, even though matzah doesn't feel or taste like it, but it is the
instrument.
It's the instrument, it's the vessel, right? Because not even on the Mizbeach, right? You read the Torah, right? The Mizbeach, there's sometimes where you get to mix oil and the flour, right? But there are certain prescribed prescriptions where it says that mincha is matzah without chametz, right? So you're offering this thing on the altar that, you know, that's constantly said, you know, don't inflate it. It can't be in, you know, so that's why. That's where I'm going. It's a very, it's not the usual way of reading it, because we think about freedom. I can puff it up, I can make it big, I can do whatever, because I have no shackles. But it's the rabbis pointing us to the direction of, it's really the opposite of that. And when you have freedom, you need to be in a place of humility to really experience it. And that's why I read it like that. And, you know, bring it to your Seder and see what the people do with it. Right? See, offer that reading and see, you know, like, and have a debate. That would be amazing. Right? That's just, if this is one of the purposes of this class is to offer you something, some alternative to bring to your Seder, this is one of them. Okay, so we're up to, so with this whole idea of two, why is this night different from all other nights? As on all other nights, we dip once. On this night, we dip twice. So Matkif La Rava. So Rava strongly objects to this statement. Atu kol yama la sagya dola matbila chada zimna. So this is our little piece of Aramaic. That is to say that on every other day there is no alternative but to dip once. And we know that that's not true. Ela amar Rava. Hachi Kitane. This is really what the Rava says. This is what the Mishnah really wants to teach us. Shevachol halalot ein anu chayavim litabel afilu pam echad halayla hazesh deif amim. So according to Rava, which is going to be, I'm going to just say it's not going to be accepted, that on all other nights we are not obligated to dip even once. However, on this night we are obligated to dip twice. So they're going to go a little crazy on the obligation part.
So I think Rob is actually proposing a different way to read the is correcting the wording of the Mishnah.
That's correct.
Okay.
He's correcting the Mishnah, because the Mishnah says, right, that we dip once during, you know, that there's a system that we dip during the year, and everybody's saying, no, we don't dip at all. We never dip. But then what he does is, in correcting it, he brings a chiyuv, right, and the rabbis are going to be uncomfortable because there is no chiyuv for during the year to mitabel, to dip your vegetables into salt water or hummus. What else might you dip in? Hummus, avocado.
I have a feeling that they did dip things, so that the obligation is, I think, is the...
It's practice versus obligation. Obligation says that if you do not do it, you are, you have sin upon you.
But they must have done it because it is included that on all other nights you can give once. But he's saying that you're not obligated to give up.
No, he's saying that you are, on all other nights we are not obligated. Right, Einanu, right, we are not chayavim.
But they must have been a practice where there was some dipping going on during the year. Why would they have suggested it in the beginning?
I agree, there was, but it's about...
It's not a must.
But it's not a must. It was just a custom. That's why I'm saying it was just a custom, it was a practice.
Food you ate that night.
Right. Hummus, yes.
Earlier on it said we do dip once.
I know.
Right.
I know. Right. But
he's saying we're not obligated.
We're not obligated. They did dip, but there was dipping.
There was some dipping because they wanted to dip, they did.
But it wasn't an obligation.
That's correct. So we have Matkif La Rav Safra. So now Rav Safra is going to strongly object to Rava's explanation. He doesn't like it. He says, Kiyuva Lidar Dekay. So, are you, you know, is there an obligation for children? Is it obligatory for children? Right? Because if, you know, they're partaking in it. Right? As previously mentioned, the reason one dips twice is to encourage the children to ask questions. How can it be called an obligation? Right? How can it be called an obligation? So he's, like I said, Rav Safra is really uncomfortable with the language of Rava with using chiyuv. Ela ama Rav Safra, hachi ketane ein anu matbilin afilu pamachat halayla hazesh tevamim. But rather Rav Safra said that this was what the Mishnah is teaching. We do not normally dip even once. However, on this night, we dip twice. And the comment is, this wording is preferable as it indicates the performance of an optional act. And that's during the year. Okay? We good? All right. Here's one of the questions. Matchil beginut misayem b'shevach. Right, we begin with disgrace and conclude with glory. They want to know what this means. My genut, so what is disgrace, or what is, you know, what is the low point? Rav Amar, mitchila ovdei avodat gilulim, or avodat zara, hayu avotenu. Ushmuel, his partner, Amar avadim hayinu. So the genut is, you begin the story with the ancestors worshipped idols, and Shmuel says, Avadim Hayinu. So we know what the Haggadah chooses.
Avadim Hayinu.
But in the telling of the story itself, right, when the Haggadah, after Avadim Hayinu, is, they begin the story with the ancestors were idolaters, and we bring up Abraham and, right, and smashing the idols or whatever else is included.
More of a disgrace.
I mean, again, one is the beginning of the strike. If we think about it, one is the beginning of the story, right, of Abraham, and the other is much more particular to Egypt. So it depends on where are you. Do you want the whole story? Okay, so we have one idolatry. Somebody else? Jay votes for idolatry.
I would vote for idolatry, too, because that is volition.
But that's probably too many years before the slavery, so the Pesach would be 3 days rather than 2 days. So maybe they decided to. But I have a question.
So hold on, but let's adjust. Okay, so what do you think? Anybody have strong feelings either way? Our ancestors were idolaters, or the story of Pesach? And like I said, both are worked in. It's just that one starts the story of Avadim Hayinu, right? And the other one is about, you know, the other one is when we're telling the story, we tell it from the beginning.
Okay. I think in the Torah they say that we need to celebrate the Pesach based on the Exodus. So it should, that's the reason maybe they chose Avadim Ayinu, because it's connected to the story in the Torah itself.
Mm-hmm.
That I think why they chose it.
Well, the Egyptian experience is the beginning of national identity in some way. I don't have an answer, so I'm groping for something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bobby said something about volition or something. Yeah, like idolatry is like a volition, voluntary act, while Avadim is we were enslaved by others.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the beginning of the identity as a group, as an entity. National identity in some way from the Egyptian time on, not before.
Right.
So that's like a real demarcation line, I think.
And I think there's a lot of tension. I think that there's tension within the tradition between those two stories. The story that starts with Abraham, right, Lech Lecha from the beginning, to the story of the Exodus. Right. I think that, you know, the Exodus is the formation of peoplehood. We literally become Am Yisrael, right, the people of Israel, or the nation of Israel, versus Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel who belong to Jacob, right? So one is familial, clan, tribe, into, like you said.
But the 400 years actually began, to make the numbers work, the count began before the actual Mitzrayim, so begins back at the
right, so the 400 years is included at the Brit Ben HaBitarim, when God says to Abraham, I'm going to enslave your children. Right. So perhaps it's bringing us back to there, right? That's where it's really started.
But people think of it, you know, the name was anybody other than Abraham, so... Oh, I'm sorry. So, our history officially started with the Jewish person, Abraham. So our ancestors were not on De Gilulim. Maybe Abraham's ancestors, but they're not part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why we were of De Gilulim. Theoretically, we were never on De Gilulim. Theoretically.
No, but the Abraham people is the ancestor world.
That's so what I just said. But our history doesn't start from his ancestors. Our history starts from him.
Start with his father.
The Lo Chashuv, that's not possible.
No, but the father is part of it, and the rabbis at least write the Midrashim around, you know, Abraham becoming the monotheist that the rabbis think that he became.
Yeah, the apocryphal text is full of that. It's huge and interesting story in the apocryphal text about it, but in the Bible, but Tanakh, it just, okay.
But don't forget,
Lech Lecha.
Right.
Starts with Lech Lecha.
But you're in right. But you're in a rabbinic right. Right. So, and it's also, don't forget, you're in the core of rabbinic text.
Yeah.
So the apocryphal stuff is just as important. Is just as important as the Torah Shebichtav. Torah Shebaal Peh is just as powerful and has just as much, you know, power as Bichtav. Yeah.
Question
so,
for the
hold on a second. Bobby, I just said that the power of... Okay, I'm just making sure. Okay.
The question of the Gnut in regard to Jacob, Arami Oved Avi, that Jacob chose to work for Laban, it was by election. He elected. It wasn't forced like in Egypt. We were forced.
Mm-hmm.
That was by election. So why we would call it Gnut?
Do we call it Gnut?
Yeah, because when we said that he worked 20 years for Laban just to get his wives, that was Gnut. He was a slave, basically, or whatever at that time we could manage it. So...
The first seven was volition. I'm going to work for Rachel.
That was elective.
Yes, I said, by election. Then, so maybe the 14 years after, or at least the 7 years working for the reality of Rachel, was forced.
You know what is the difference between Chacham and Pikeach? That Chacham doesn't get into a situation that Pikeach can get out of.
Okay.
Okay? So, he knew what he's getting into, and it was elective. So, my question is, why would we take this as a gnut if somebody chose
but
to be in a situation.
Hold on a second. I think we were reading it into it, but the only thing we're required to do is doresh, right? That was not, right, the gnut and the shevach was separate. There were two things that we were required to do. To tell the story of gnut to shevach, period, and to doresh on Avi Oved, Arami Oved Avi. Two separate things, right? The question is, why are we supposed to doresh that, right? That was my question, right? Why do we have to look at that? What about that is so essential to the story that we have to expound on it? And if you look in the Haggadah, right, they do all sorts of crazy readings of it, right? That's where the Midrashim are lively and they're reading it in all sorts of really crazy, crazy ways. But it's about Higadita versus the Gnut to the Shevach. So there are two levels happening, or two different things happening, one and one. So you shouldn't cross over and say one is reflecting the other. So it's 9:00. So what would you like to do? We didn't really. So hold on. Can we just do a teeny? Can I just read through something that I just want you to pay attention to?
Yeah, sure.
Is that okay? All right. So now we're up to. I want to skip a little bit. Okay. So let's see. All right, so let me do this quickly. Amar le Rav Nachman le Daru Avdei. So this is about the conversation that Rav Nachman has with his slave Daru, and he says, and I'm just going to do it in English, right? So he says, a slave who is freed by his master, who gives him gold and silver, what should the slave say to him? Daru said to him, he must thank and praise his master. He said to him, if so, you have exempted us from reciting the question of why is this night different, as you have stated the essence of the Seder night. Rav Nachman immediately began to recite, we were slaves. So, right, just to bring in this whole idea that there's a voice for Daru the slave, because Rav Nachman is saying, what would it be like if I freed you and I gave you gold and silver, right? So God frees the Israelites. The Egyptians give them gold and silver because they have a lot to make all sorts of good things and not so good things in the desert. And he's saying that, well, if it's about, right, it's about Thanksgiving. It says here, Ba'e le'oduye u'lishaboche, right, that you need to give Thanksgiving from, right, Hoda'ah and Shevach, right, so you need to do that. Rav Nachman is saying, whoops, I don't know, you just gave us the, made us patur from saying manashtana. And they don't like that, right? But he's kind of kibitzing with him, saying, oh, what do I have to focus on? Avadim hayinu. Not so much the question, or the questions of manashtana. Right, that's just kind of an alternative reading to the experience of being freed from slavery. Right, because if that's the story, right? Why am I telling them, again, a different level of question. Why do I have to ask the Manashtana? Why don't I just jump in and do Avadim Hayinu?
A very poignant little story.
Go ahead.
It's the night of Pesach.
Mm-hmm.
This rabbi has a slave haunting him with the idea of freeing him. And it doesn't say freedom at all. To me, it's a disconcerting little story.
Yeah. Although the reality is, He's paskening a halacha in a funny way.
But putting that aside, the reality of the story.
Oh, that they had slaves?
That they're using a story about a slave to illustrate the freedom that we're supposed to feel. And he's saying to the slave, what would you do if I gave you a lot of money and freed you?
Well, he's talking to him in the third person, but yes, I hear you.
And there's no sense that he frees him.
Right.
Different notion, I think.
No, but Jake, there's a slave here. I'm not saying, I understand it was a different reality, but to me it's a disconcerting story to include in a teaching about Pesach.
I agree.
That's all.
I agree. But Didn't Hamilton have slaves?
Yeah, but to make a point that I'm freedom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I hear that.
Slave that you're not free is, to me, true.
Yes. But ironic, too.
Yes.
Ironic. Yeah, he doesn't, I mean, at least, yeah, I think Daru appears a few times in the Talmud, so, you know, it's like he has a relationship with him, but...
Maybe it's one of those phrases that says, I don't want to go free.
Is he, at other times, insensitive? I don't know Rav Nachman's teaching deep enough to say yes and or no.
Interesting to trace things about Rav Nachman.
Eved Nirtza, maybe it's an Eved Nirtza, you know? Those who said, I don't want to be free.
Eved Nirtza is only Eved Ivri.
Well, I mean, he says Avde, it says servant, so I think he's a, my understanding, he's a not a Jewish slave.
Yeah, it's Eved Knani.
Or whatever they have at that time. Okay, so this is what I wanted to so it's in the Mishnah. I'm going to read it. Rabban Gamliel haya omer kosha lo amar shalosha devarim elu bapesach lo yatsa yedei chovotel ve'elu hem. Right, so this is what we're obligated to say at the night of Pesach. Elu hem Pesach matzah umarar. And we know that intimately from the Haggadah, right? Pesach al shum shepasach hamakom al batei avoteinu b'mitzrayim שנאמר ואמרתם זבח פסח הוא להשם אשר פסח וגומר. Right, so because God passed over the houses of our ancestors, right, during Makat Bechorot. Masa, על שום שנגלעו אבותינו ממצרים.
נגלעו.
Yep, sorry. שנאמר ויפו את הבצק אשר הוציאו ממצרים וגומר. Right, so the matzah is because we didn't have when we left Mitzrayim, we didn't have enough time to bake the matzah, bake the bread. Maror al shum shemeruru haMitzriim al chayei avotenu b'Mitzrayim shenemar v'yemaru et chayehim v'gomer. Right, so they embitter their lives, and this is what I wanted to bring to you. Bechol dor vador chayav adam lirot et atzmom ki ilu hu yatsa mimitzrayim shene'emar vihigadta levincha bayom hahu lemor ba'avur zeh Hashem li betzeiti asar Hashem li betzeiti mimitzrayim. So the Tan of the Mishnah continues. It says in every generation a person is, and it says adam, so I'm just saying men and women are included in human beings, that a human being is obligated to see himself or herself as if he left Mitzrayim. That it says that you should tell your children on this very day to say, because of this, God did this for me in leaving Mitzrayim. Which is really interesting because it's answers to, right, he got his Alevincha, it's an answer to, isn't it an answer to the Tam, I think? I think one of the answers to the children are this question as well. But the reason what, right, because we were talking about seeing ourselves in the story, right, that we do all of this, we teach our children, we have a Seder, we do all of the telling, we do all the experiential stuff to see ourselves as if we left Egypt. That there is an obligation, chayav, where the rabbis aren't so comfortable to say that we're chayav for a lot of things, right? We are chayav in seeing ourselves, not only telling the story, but telling the story brings ourselves into the story by telling the story. So I'm hoping that this Pesach, you will be able to bring yourself into the story and your family and your friends, and that you bring the question, what does it mean to be obligated, right, to see yourself as if you left Egypt, and maybe it's bringing about Zaru and the iniquity in the...
Can I ask you about that? Do you think it encompasses Chayav, to see yourself as if you departed from Egypt? Does that encompass trying to feel what it was like to be a slave, or just to feel free?
I think it's to make the move.
The transition.
Right, from, right. Because that's the leaving. Ki'ilu hu yatsa.
Right, I'm saying right. The leaving doesn't necessarily imply the feeling, the slavery.
Of course it's, I mean, at least in my understanding.
It means from departing from slavery. It could have been phrased differently.
Sheyatsami Mitzrayim, right, is kind of the metaphoric language of taking those steps. What was it like to take that first step away from being a slave?
It could have been phrased Ki'ilu hu haya, you know, avad ben Mitzrayim veyatsami Mitzrayim, something like that.
But it's about, right, that it's about the leaving, right?
Right. I know. It doesn't say the living and the leaving. It just says the leaving.
So this is something from the Rambam. I have something from the Rambam. Let me read this to you. It says, in every generation, one must view himself as though he personally just left Egypt. Just left Egypt. So all I'm going to say is, and we don't experience this, but what must have it been like when the masters in the South let those slaves go? And what did it feel like, right? Because we know that many of the slaves stayed on the plantation, because they weren't given the skills to leave, and we are suffering the iniquities of the ancestors throughout the generations because of that, right? So it's the same thing. Why do you think that when the Israelites were kvetching, what did they say? It was so much better in Egypt. Moshe, why did you do this to us? We don't have anything good to eat. We don't drink any water. Our feet are hurting. Yada, yada, yada. Because the experience of the first people leaving, and this is why I think that they needed to die out in the desert after those 40 years, is that they couldn't imagine themselves as free.
Look, no,
I see it. That's interpretation, because the words don't make that
right.
What does he say? What is Lotowitz say?
You need to see yourself as a slave that departed from Egypt.
Right, so that's because he's asking the same question, because it's unclear.
Right.
But I think that, I think it's those moments, what it must have been like to feel like unshackled, untethered, you know, and be able to walk in, you know, because they were also, you know, it was complicated. They didn't want to go into the water, right, Moshe? What are you bringing us to the edge of the... I mean, it was 40 years of kvetch, and it was always better back there. And I think that it was always better back there is the experience of that slave trying to gain freedom, and God is trying to give them as many tools,
yep.
And ultimately they have to die out and have... The new generation be able to go in, and it's not a great story either, Yehoshua and capturing...
No, but I think Mark's point is a good one. I certainly never thought about this before, but maybe the rabbis what they're saying is you need to reflect on the beneficence of God and the fact that you need to talk about Shabbos, to talk about what you have received, because maybe they were aware of the fact that nobody has the imagination to be able to actually imagine what living in those circumstances was, and they're just stressing that other part of the story.
It could be, but I want to say lehefech, that the rabbis severely felt what it meant to be enslaved. Right, because you have the 10 martyrs, right?
Oh, I see.
You know, so it's like, they know what it was to be enslaved by the Romans, right, and still be able to have a rich... Right, a rich intellectual, corpus or anything like that. But right.
Historically, that was probably more typical of our experience. So you're right. I'm speaking to somebody living right now.
Wow, that we
no,
have.
No, I think.
But I think that, but even for them, right, even for them, right, if Rabbi Akiva's on the scene, he's meeting, right, with the zealots and planning the revolution, the rebellion of Bar Kokhba during the Passover time. And even they're saying we have to imagine ourselves as if we were slaves or we were in Mitzrayim having freedom when they had nowhere nearly the freedom that we have. So it's a kal v'chomer, or it's a chomer v'kal, I don't know, is that we have to imagine ourselves in this land of plenty and opportunity and religious freedom beyond anybody's imagination and still say, in a moment around the Seder, I have to see myself as if I'm here in the story, leaving.
You know, the mentioning that you mentioned before that we kvetch for 40 years. The problem is that nobody saw the vision that Moses had. So they didn't see what's coming to them. They only knew what happened in the past and how bad it is now. So you cannot complain against the concept of kvetching for 40 years. Because people who don't know where they are going to, it's very difficult to convince them to stick with you.
I mean, that could be true, but I'm telling you, you know, seeing God or experiencing the splitting of the sea or the miracle, the 10, you know, miracles, Sinai, whatever.
Maybe it's just the story.
Well, you can't have both sides of it. You can't have both. That's talking from both sides of your mouth. Yes, you are.
He's a specialist in that.
Within the framework of the story, they experience those things.
We have a little faith.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, hopefully you have something. Hopefully you will have a different Seder. That was the whole point. What?
Different Seder.
Amen. Alo davar. Yes, for sure. You can keep whatever you want.